You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 17th of April 2019 on Monocle 24. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up...
Today, with this election, we begin to stand up for ourselves, for our jobs, and for our future. Today, we Albertans begin to fight back.
A swing to the right in part of Canada as the country's prime minister tries to get back on track. 6 months before Justin Trudeau is due to face the voters' verdicts, we'll get an update. A former president of Peru takes his own life as police arrive to arrest him on corruption claims. We'll have more later on the death of Alan Garcia. Libya's prime minister warns of a new migration crisis as violence continues around the capital. But which nations will be willing to help? And later, we'll hear about the revival of a once legendary culture magazine.
A number of people come up to me saying that this magazine was like a portal to this incredible world they wanted to be a part of. It's quite touching to hear that, and I feel really honoured and proud to be bringing it back.
And we'll find out why the Bank of England's governor has joined warnings about the impact of climate change. All to come in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. Well, welcome to the Monocle Daily. It has not been an easy few weeks for Justin Trudeau. Just a few months from federal elections, Canada's Prime Minister faces allegations that he's tried to interfere in a criminal case. And now he has seen the political right gain control of another province with a victory of the United Conservative Party in Alberta. Well, in a moment, we'll assess the wider implications of that and Mr. Trudeau's attempts to fight back. But let's begin in Alberta with Monocle's Sheena Rossiter. Sheena, the UCP, the United Conservative Party, appear to have pretty much routed the opposition in these elections. And what lies behind these results?
Well, this was a complete landslide victory, and it was a very unsurprising one. It was an estimated 1% chance that the party that was in power, the New Democratic Party, the NDP as we know them here, would remain in power. So this wasn't really surprising, but this what really fueled this election was jobs, the economy, and pipelines. Alberta is really hurting since the price of oil has plummeted, and this is such an oil-rich, commodity-driven province. Just to give you an idea, about a third of the people who live in the province have jobs directly related to oil and gas. So a lot of people got laid off and lost jobs in that sector. And we do feel it as a bit of a ripple effect in the rest of the province as well, because people are simply spending less in other areas. For example, people are going less to restaurants and things like that. So people in the service industry can't really get as much business as they used to when oil was at peak boom prices. So the idea of getting the Trans Mountain Pipeline built, which will go from here in Edmonton to the coast at in Vancouver to get oil from our landlocked province to market, has dominated this election.
So much talk about the economy, about those oil pipelines. I mean, what do we know about the man who's going to be Alberta's next premier?
Well, he did work in the federal government for a little while. He was the immigration minister for a while, and he did really play on that rhetoric a little bit, because there was some issues during the campaign that a few of the people that were campaigning in several of the ridings were making racist and homophobic comments. So he was trying to play a little bit on that by saying that he has a diverse team and that he basically knows what it's like to bring foreigners into the country, because he was in that position in Ottawa before.
Now, this win ends 4 years in charge in Alberta for the NDP, the left-leaning party. But there was a sense, wasn't there, that was perhaps something of a flash in the pan. This is a naturally small-c conservative area.
That's right. Alberta is staunchly conservative. And in fact, when the NDP came to power back in 2015, that was a bit of a surprise, because that actually ended a long-running conservative rule that had existed in this province since 1971. And essentially, Albertan voters basically were fed up with the corruption of the conservative parties, and they were fed up with how things were going, namely with jobs and the economy, as well at that point as the price of oil did start to go down 4 years ago already.
Now, you mentioned that anger over the economy, over oil, over the pipeline that has driven this surge to the UCP here, but there's a danger, isn't there, for anyone who's elected on that kind of wave of popular anger, that if you don't deal with the causes of the anger that put you in power in the first place, voters will pretty quickly start to blame you for it not changing.
That's right. He definitely does have some big shoes to fill, because there is, as I mentioned, a lot of jobs have been bled over here in Alberta, and that is what a lot of people are angry about. There are some big issues also here at play. You know, people are concerned over what he will do with health care, what he will do with affordable child care. So there are other things that people are looking at. But pipeline politics 101 is always a hot topic here in Alberta, and that is definitely what people are going to be talking about. And that will have greater implications into the federal election as well. Since Alberta is so oil rich, a lot of what comes from this province definitely impacts the rest of the country, since it is one of the more wealthier provinces.
Sheena Rossiter in Alberta, thank you very much. Let's speak now to Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis. You, Tom, were at an event last night, a town hall involving Trudeau. Was this an attempt to try to move past this scandal that's been so dominating the headlines the last few weeks?
It absolutely was. And I think, Paul, it marked a sort of return to a kind of strategy that Trudeau has really put at the heart of the kind of public appearances he likes to give to the public and potential voters. The town hall has been something, he said last night, that he's done around 35 or 40 of during his time as Prime Minister since he was elected in 2015. Now, the last time he did one of these was just before the SNC-Lavalin scandal broke. And they've been noticeably absent from his schedules in the weeks at the height of the storm, if you like. So this was the first time that he conducted a town hall in the town of Cambridge, Ontario, which is around an hour and a half away to the west of Toronto. The first kind of event like this he'd done since that scandal. So I think quietly there was kind of quite a lot of pressure on him. This is a rather large event. There were around 1,350 people there, all poised with their questions. And he did take a lot of questions on a huge array of subjects, including the SNC-Lavalin scandal, which I should say only really came up once, and which he sort of dealt with in a slightly sort of distanced kind of way. He really has tried to shift the focus from this onto the main pillars, as he sees it, I think, of his re-election campaign, and that is the budget that was unveiled last month, that really puts the focus on younger voters and older voters as well, and looks at different ways of really sort of getting the economy going again. And those are the kind of appearances we've seen him do in the wake of this scandal as it's rolled on. He's been to manufacturing plants, to places of education, places where he can, in a more controlled setting, I think, kind of give his pitch to the public that despite trust being eroded in him during the SNC-Lavalin scandal, that actually he is the right man to be re-elected Prime Minister. So last night was no small stakes for him. And I think they'll be quietly pleased with how it went, frankly.
As you say, that also his strategy, not just to try and move on from that issue, but to talk about the budget and to talk about the issues that he thinks he performs better on. But after that election in Alberta, there are only three now of Canada's 10 provinces that have Liberal-leaning governments. And 6 months out from a general election, that's a worry.
Well, I think Alberta particularly is quite a particular case. As you heard from Sheena earlier, the result back in 2015 in the election in Alberta was one of the most dramatic political stories in recent Canadian history. So I think there was maybe some sense that perhaps the swing back to a more sort of comfortable conservative message was maybe expected there. I think you are right in alluding to the fact that there are some quite dramatic changes happening happening in the politics of Canada elsewhere. Here in Ontario, we have a populist conservative premier who is tearing up the rule book and is instituting a lot of policies that are garnering a lot of negative headlines to some, but a lot of sort of favourable ones to the hardcore of his supporters. Canada, in electoral terms, is quite a splintered place. This is a vast, vast country. And, you know, a voter in British Columbia might not feel that the same issues as, say, a voter in Manitoba or Saskatchewan really apply to them. So I think that's what was really captured in this town hall meeting last night. And perhaps that's why Justin Trudeau likes doing them so much, is you really get a huge array of questions, which he hasn't been given advance notice of. And, you know, it really puts him on the spot and forces him to get the best of his political juices out, if you like, to really rise to the occasion and to answer a disparate array of questions that I think do represent just how vast and disparate an electoral landscape Canada really is.
Now, I've been to a few of these sort of similar events in British election campaigns, and they are profoundly tightly controlled. They know exactly who's in the audience. They know exactly what they're going to say. It's basically it's a form of theatre, but you're suggesting something here that the Prime Minister is willing to throw himself into an encounter in which he has no idea what he's going to be asked or what direction it's going to go in.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there were moments last night, particularly when climate change in various forms, we heard from Sheena earlier talking about the controversial pipeline project that was raised several times at this town hall, and that got the angriest response. There were several hecklers. Some were taken away from the hall when they wouldn't stop berating the Prime Minister. He, I should say, dealt with it very, very calmly, and it didn't seem to throw him too much. His responses to those sort of rebuffs, if you like, were pretty on point. I think, you know, what's interesting about the town hall format in the way that Trudeau does them is that it's obviously a very old-fashioned format, you know, gathering people in one place to ask the person in power the burning topic in their lives of the day. But I think what, for the Trudeau team, which has been so good, if you like, at controlling the PR and controlling the message of so many things since it was elected into office in 2015, is that, you know, if there is a moment where someone in the audience breaks down in tears, for example, like happened last night, or if someone gets very angry with the Prime Minister and he offers a very good off-the-cuff kind of riposte that, you know, is respectful to the questioner, but also kind of shows him standing his ground, that thing is really golden, I think, for a Prime Minister seeking re-election in the internet age, that, you know, he was there for a very grueling 2 hours answering questions non-stop. But at the end of the day, it does boil down to, say, the minute clip, I think, that will be shared and that will either reaffirm his voters' kind of support for him or the feelings that people led people to vote for him in the first place, or on the other side will kind of confirm, I suppose, kind of the feelings of his opponents, that he isn't sort of up to the job and that his first term has been something of a disappointment. It is a rather high stakes thing, but I get the sense, and got the sense last night seeing him interact with the voters gathered in Cambridge, Ontario, that he does really get something of a buzz from having things thrown at him. There were several school children who asked him questions. There were older members of the audience who are retirees or army veterans who were throwing all sorts of things at him. And he is a very acute political operator, and I think he really thrives on being able to show those skills in an environment where he isn't totally sure how it's going to go.
Thomas Lewis in Toronto, thank you very much. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. From Canada, we move on to Libya now, and it's thought that at least 6 people were killed in the latest shelling in Libya's capital. Residential areas of Tripoli were hit in attacks that have been blamed by the UN-backed government there on supporters of General Khalifa Haftar, the warlord who launched an assault on the city several weeks ago. Well, Libya's current prime minister has warned that the latest violence could trigger an exodus of refugees, potentially hundreds of thousands of people, who could flee. Well, with me in the studio is Sally Hayne, a journalist who focuses on the issues around migration. Thank you very much coming in this evening. Have you been able to speak to people in Tripoli on the ground about what's going on there?
Yeah, I'm speaking constantly to refugees and migrants who are in detention centres in various locations in Tripoli. Some are on the side that has now been taken by Haftar, and some are on the UN recognised government side.
And what are they telling you about the situation?
They're just totally terrified. I mean, for them, most of them are people who have tried to get to Europe already and were on boats that were intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard, who are backed by the EU, and brought back. So they've been locked up for months or else years and essentially have no control over their own fate, and they're just waiting to see what's going to happen. And I think everybody thought that there was going to be another conflict because there was very bad fighting last year, and they've just been waiting for this.
Now, this warning from Libya's prime minister echoes one that Italy's prime minister issued a few days ago, warning about the risks of another mass migration out of Libya. Obviously, his concern is that his country will be one of the ones that will bear the brunt of that if you were to return to what you saw a few years ago of large numbers of people taking to boats trying to get across the Mediterranean.
Well, yeah, but also I think his concern is getting or maintaining power, and he's essentially using refugees and migrants as a threat, from what I can see, to try and encourage the international community to continue supporting him. Because what he's saying is, this is what's going to happen if you don't help me stay in power.
And one of the differences, presumably one of the dangers, if there is to be another huge movement of people, is that 3-4 years ago, a number of EU countries, Germany, for example, stepped in and offered to take people. And there's been such a shift in the political temperature in so many European countries that it would now politically be very difficult for those same countries to do that now.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think that there's going to be that big flow of people, to be honest, because now, like, they've criminalised search and rescue effectively. They are still paying, so the EU is paying tens of millions of euro to fund the Libyan Coast Guard to intercept boats and bring people back to Libya. And that EU money, I think, is still going to continue to be paid. So I can't really see that happening. I think more what's happening is that he's making a threat. He's essentially saying, support me or else I'm going to unleash waves of, you know, migrants and refugees on you. And he knows that Europe will respond to that.
And in the midst of that, are people, you see, obviously some people have said that this could become, I think the phrase was, the new Syria. And in the midst of that will be people who, you've been speaking to people in Tripoli who are terrified, who may decide that they want to leave the city. If the EU is then funding the Libyan Coast Guard to round them up and take them back, you get into a vicious circle. People are trying to escape, but they end up back where they started.
Yeah, and I think that there needs to be more interrogation and investigation into how that EU money has been funding militias, and it has been encouraging this kind of, like, this unstable atmosphere, because what they've been doing is effectively paying a lot of money to stop migration, which is why it's such a key topic. And a lot of that money, from what I know, like, a lot of the detention centres are being run by militias, and they're not necessarily aligned to the UN-backed government. Like, now they are, they've decided that they are, but that government isn't as in control as the name government kind of suggests.
Well, indeed, there seems to be some division in the international community on this, that on the one hand, the United Nations is backing what we always call the sort of the UN-backed government. But then there are other countries, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, France, I think, has been reported sometimes as suggesting that Haftar could be seen as an alternative choice, as a source of stability. So there isn't even a consistent line from the international community on what outcome it wants in Libya.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, I'm not, like, I wouldn't call myself a Libya expert at all. For me, like, my main reporting topic is migration, and I'm just in touch with migrants and refugees in detention centres. But from their perspective, they knew that something like this was going to happen. Like, what they see around them is militias. They see militias who are kind of having skirmishes between themselves and who aren't necessarily under the control of, you know, the GNA, the UN-backed government, and they haven't seen kind of any sort of stability so far. So this has been expected. So I don't know if Haftar would be better or worse, and they're all asking me that too. But
is there a sense that some take the view that it almost doesn't matter which of these different groups is in charge of the nominal Libyan government, that their situation isn't necessarily going to improve?
I don't know. I mean, they've been asking me, well, would Haftar treat them better? It's very hard to tell, but I think the idea, I think it's more that the EU has been treating Libya like it's somewhere almost stable, and even this idea of calling, like, the GNA, the government, like the Siraj, the prime minister, it gives you this sense that it's an operating state and it's not, you know, it's a country full of militias who are battling each other. And even if there hasn't been an outbreak of big conflict like this in a few months, it's only been a few months, you know. So, you know, the EU has been treating it like it's stable, but it's been a war zone all along and they've been funding the Libyan Coast Guard to return people there.
Sally Hayden, thank you very much for coming in this evening. Stay with us next on The Monocle Daily. We'll take a look at the revival of a once legendary magazine. We'll also explore an Art Deco masterpiece in Portland. And in just a moment, more warnings about the dangers of climate change.
California, here we come. Monocle has arrived on the West Coast. Our new shop and bureau is open at Platform, the design quarter in Culver City, that's home to 100 boutique retail and culinary brands. If you're in town, pop along to meet the team, pick up the latest issue of the magazine and browse our exclusive collaborations. From elegant stationery to smart jackets, plus plenty in the way of print, of course. Discover our range from furniture to fragrances, courtesy of brands from the US and beyond. Intrigued? Then come and see us at our new LA outpost at Platform in Culver City. We look forward to meeting you there.
Now, for a third day, environmental protesters have brought parts of central London to a halt. After blocking key roads and bridges, today some activists switched their attention to the public transport system. At one stage, three people glued themselves to a train. Well, meanwhile, the governor of the Bank of England has been issuing his own warning about climate change. Mark Carney, together with the head of France's central bank, says global warming poses an existential threat to the financial system that underpins much of the world. Well, earlier Monocle's Daphne Carnesa spoke to Professor Samuel Fankhauser, who is the director of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change. And she began by asking him whether Mark Carney's input means that it can no longer be regarded as a secondary concern to business.
Yeah, I think it's a hugely important signal. Mark Carney in particular has been well aware of climate change for a while and has sort of commissioned important work in this space. But the fact that central banks and financial regulators more broadly are starting to understand climate change risks, but then also the sort of the climate change opportunities that go with it is hugely significant. We're in the process of mainstreaming. It's an ugly word, but we're really, climate change concerns are entering normal economic decision making in central banks, in financial institutions and businesses all over the world.
So how would you describe these risks of climate change on business and on the finance sector? I mean, from what I understand, it's not just the physical risks, you know, things like extreme weather, which of course will have a big impact on things like the insurance industry, but also the risks of the transition itself and companies having to adapt to this sort of low carbon economy.
That's right. There are those two generic types of risks, and they have been termed, as you just used, transition risks, which is the risk associated with investing in fossil fuel heavy assets that you then can't run to the end of their economic life. So you create stranded assets. And then there's the physical risk, the risks of climate change itself, of storms and droughts and heat waves. And both of them do affect the sort of assets that the financial sector invests in, or the businesses that the banks give loans to. So those are both significant risks. Transition risks are probably more tangible immediately, but we can already see the physical risks manifesting themselves as well.
Are there any more specific examples that you can give us? I know that Mark Carney has spoken about things like the falling sales of diesel cars.
Yeah, I mean, the examples are everywhere. If you look at the on the transition risks, if you look at the electric power sector, firms that that hold power generation assets based on fossil fuels, coal assets, gas assets, they have to be aware that they will not be able to run those power plants to the end of their economic life. We know that the carbon space that is left for this sector is such that none of those, literally nothing that we build today in the power sector that emits carbon can be run for more than 10, 15 years. So people have to be aware of that. That's the power sector. In the transport sector, the internal combustion engine is on its way out. So people who invest in companies that are not good at electric cars, they will run economic risks. But it goes broader than that still. In the service sector, construction firms, advisory firms that are not good at building low carbon homes or building low carbon infrastructure, they will not survive in this new economy. Their skills will be wrong. In the financial sector itself, if financiers don't understand the sort of the financial and economic features of a clean energy project, they will not survive in the low carbon economy. So those risks go across everything, every economic activity that we're engaged in.
And what do you think that businesses can do to help green themselves and to cope?
Well, there's a lot they can do. And obviously the flip side of the risks is the opportunities. So firms that know how to position themselves have massive green or low carbon opportunities for themselves. So firms that are good at electric cars, firms that are good at climate resilient infrastructure, firms that can't construct infrastructure that's fit for the 21st century, they will lose out. But firms who are capable of doing that, they have huge opportunities. There are some countries, China and South Korea in particular, that have explicitly positioned their industries as being the leaders in the low carbon economy. And you see them taking market shares from countries that haven't had that foresight. Obviously, central banks, it's in their nature that they have to worry about the downside risks. But the story we are telling in our research here at the Grantham Research Institute is the story of the possibilities. We look at the size of the green economy as it already exists today. And if you just look at the amount of turnover that is produced in listed firms today, that turnover is probably not very dissimilar to the turnover that comes out of the oil and gas industry. So the green economy is here, the opportunities are here today, and they're growing. So the fact that central banks worry about risks shouldn't distract us from the fact that the opportunities go alongside it.
And that's Professor Samuel Fankhauser, the director of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change. Well, as we mentioned earlier, climate change protests are continuing in many parts of central London. And earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall went to Waterloo Bridge to speak to some of those who've joined the demonstrations.
My name's Rick Page. I'm from Salisbury. I'm the head teacher of Wordsworth Primary School in Southampton. And I'm here for the children in my school and for the 90 children who are due to start in September, who will probably live, most of them to 100. So I'm not that good at maths. That's why I'm a head teacher. But you can get the point I'm making. The children that start in my school are going to be here in the year 2120.
Why do you think it's important for events like this to maybe shock people a bit into talking about it in a more engaged way?
Because I think in our own way, it's a part of the human condition is we're very interested in ourselves, and there are a lot of things for people to worry about, aren't they? You know, they may not have a full contract, they may have a mortgage they struggle to pay. You know, there are lots of issues in people's lives, children to look after, and actually it's difficult for us to rise above that day-to-day stuff, and this sort of event actually makes people think.
My name is Saba and I come from Luton, originally Pakistan, and I'm here because scientists say we only have 12 years until the effects that we've had on the earth become irreversible. I wasn't too afraid of getting arrested. I'm not sure about these guys, but yeah, it's a sunny day, we're just having some fun. We should have the right to sit down peacefully.
Are you going to get arrested?
Maybe. Let's see what happens.
No. I would love to, but I work with vulnerable children. So if I head back to work and they're like, why did you get arrested? Like, I know as much as it is for a good cause, I can't sabotage my personal life. I wish I could. I honestly do.
I think Londoners haven't quite accepted the fact that they're alive yet. I've asked and interviewed several Londoners as they've walked past and asked them where they touch the earth. Some of them tell me that they've never even planted a daffodil or done anything. The fact that the climate is 18 years in the last 19 years has been doing some very strange and unprecedented, you know, fluctuations, fires to extreme cold in North America. It doesn't look like it's going to stop, and I think it's because it's unhealthy. We need to either cut CO2 or reforest the Amazon and the Congo and other major rainforests, or preferably both. We're cutting down 1 acre per second, and that's unacceptable. It's just unpalatable. We can't carry on like this. I know in London you're untouched by death, but you know, you're also untouched by life. And this is why I'm here, a serious message.
Some of the protesters gathered on Waterloo Bridge here in London a little earlier today. In a moment, a bizarre sequence of events that ends in the death of a former president of Peru. Before that, though, a quick look at some of the day's other top stories. An extraordinary new study has raised fundamental questions about the barrier between life and death. Scientists in the United States have been able to partially revive pig brains hours after the animals were slaughtered. The study showed that the death of brain cells can be halted and some connections restored, but there were no indications of awareness or consciousness. At least 28 people have been killed after a tourist bus plunged from a road and overturned on the Portuguese island of Madeira. The bus is thought to have been carrying 50 passengers. The cause of the crash is not yet clear. And France is inviting architects from around the world to submit designs for a new spire for the renovated Notre Dame Cathedral. The spire of the 850-year-old building was destroyed in Monday's blaze. Earlier, bells sounded at churches across France in solidarity with Notre Dame, exactly 48 hours after the fire started. This is the Monocle Daily. Now, Peru's former president, Alan Garcia, has died after a bizarre sequence of events. He shot himself as police arrived to arrest him on corruption claims, and doctors in Lima were unable to save him. Well, Natalia Soplavia Perez is a professor of Latin American history at the University of Kent here in the UK, though is currently in Peru and is on the line now. First of all, tell us a little more about what actually happened.
Well, early this morning at 6:30 a.m., the police and the judicial authorities came to Alan Garcia's house, first with a warrant to search the documents, and then once they were in the premises, they showed him the documents that he was going to be taken into preventative custody. And at that moment, he went into a different room and shot himself in the neck. He was immediately taken into the hospital, into intensive care, and for 2 hours there were attempts to save him, and he ultimately died of heart failure.
Now, the news of his death was announced by Peru's current president. How are people reacting to it?
Well, most people feel quite disappointed by the fact that he hasn't faced justice. He has been claiming for a very long time that he's innocent, but most Peruvians believe that he is definitely guilty of most of the accusations of corruption that are levied against him. Some people that defend him say that this was prosecution, politically motivated, but there's very few people that actually believe that.
Well, let's explore these allegations, because Alan Garcia served two terms as president, 16 years apart. What were the allegations that he was facing?
Well, he was facing allegations due to the Odebrecht corruption scandal, the car wash investigation that has engulfed the whole of South America because of the Brazilian giant construction company that paid bribes to most Peruvian presidents and people in Ecuador, Colombia, Brazil. And so it's a very wide-reaching scandal, and this is the latest victim. Peru's former president, Ollanta Humala, has served time. Former President Pedro Pablo Kuczynski is currently under preventative prison as well. And former presidential candidate Keiko Fujimori is also serving time for this same scandal.
Well, as you say, four former presidents under investigation, the opposition leader in prison. This does appear to be an endemic problem in Peru.
Oh, without the shadow of a doubt. And in fact, since Alan Garcia's first presidency between 1985 and 1990, he has been seen as one of the most corrupt presidents that Peru has ever had. And then we've had more corrupt presidents after him. So it's quite an accolade.
Is this a uniquely Peruvian problem? Is there a reason why the country's leaders are apparently so susceptible to alleged corruption?
There are two sides to that story. On one side, some people say that Peruvian presidents are actually being caught being corrupt, and other presidents are corrupt and they're not caught, and that justice does actually have a hand in Peru. Others say that the Peruvian system is just very geared towards corruption. It's been the way of operating for a very long time.
Well, Transparency International has Peru 101st on its list of anti-corruption success stories around the world. So it suggests that there is some action that needs to be taken there to improve matters.
Well, of course, and that is one of the things that the new president, Martin Vizcarra, has taken as his mantle. And in fact, the judicial activities in the past years have been very intense. And there has been quite an advance in terms of having people face justice. And many thought that Alan Garcia would never be prosecuted and there would never be enough evidence against him. But that was certainly not the case today. I mean, in November, he asked for asylum in the Uruguayan embassy in Lima. And he was denied asylum by Uruguay because they believed it was not a political prosecution, but there was enough evidence for him to have to face Peruvian justice. And in a sense, some people believe that Alan Garcia had never wanted to actually pay for his crimes. And many are convinced that he was guilty of them, even though he didn't actually face the judicial process.
As you say, this is not a unique allegation to Alan Garcia, but it's rare that a political leader's life, even one enmeshed in this much controversy, ends with them taking their own life in this way.
Well, that is the thing that is really surprising. I mean, even when he was president the first time, right, in the 1980s, Alan Garcia was always known for being having an imbalanced personality. It was said that he took lithium and that he had mental problems and that he had a very, very high sense of self, a very narcissistic personality. And he was convinced that he would never, ever face justice and that he'd done it all so well that he would be untouchable. And mainly because he had filled all the judicial system with his cronies, people that were receiving money from him. So the changes that have been made in the judiciary in the past years made his situation more and more complicated, because slowly the circle started to close. And as the people in Odebrecht started speaking and giving evidence and hard evidence, not just words, but actual documents and of illegal payments for him giving conferences that he never actually gave and things like that, then, you know, it was more and more possible that he would have to face justice. His father had been a political prisoner, and he had said that he would rather die by his own hand than face justice.
Natalia Saprivia Pera there in Peru with the news of the death of the former president Alan Garcia at, as we heard, his own hand. You're listening to Monocle 24. Well, next we turn to the return of a once legendary name on newsstands. The Face was for many years a vital chronicle of culture, but it closed 15 years ago. Well, now it's back online today and in print later this year. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke earlier to its editor, Stuart Bromford.
So I started reading The Face when I was about 15, I'd say, when I lived in a suburb of Bradford, and I'd go into Leeds on a Saturday shopping, get the train in, and there was a W.H. Smith in the station, and I'd always buy a copy. on the way back from Leeds and basically devour it. And it was my source of everything, knowledge of everything from music to fashion to wider features on culture. So it was a huge, it kind of opened the world up in a really amazing way for me. And since we've announced this relaunch, it's become clear that it's the same for a lot of people. The number of people who've come up to me saying that this magazine was like a portal to this incredible world they wanted to be a part of. It's quite touching to hear that, and I feel really honoured and proud to be bringing it back.
Do you feel a certain responsibility? Because, you know, the magazine is considered iconic by many. You know, there is kind of, it's almost heavy, you know, kind of the image that the face has. So what do you feel about that? Because clearly you're going to put your imprint on the brand as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge responsibility. I was getting the train back from King's Cross around Christmas and was stood looking down the wall of all the old covers and seeing about 200 metres worth of amazing iconic covers was like, oh God, that's obviously a lot of pressure. But I think the main thing with us bringing it back, obviously first through a website and then through print, is really we're just wanting to capture that same spirit, that same energy, that same exciting mix of subjects and brilliant photo shoots. In some ways, if you focus on the spirit of it, then it's actually more simple than you'd imagine, I think. If you kind of get too bogged down in the details of iconic covers that have come before and certain writers that have done great features, then you can get more bogged down in that. But really, it's just trying to focus in on the spirit of it, really.
Which I find it quite interesting. So it's not going to be, from what I'm noticing, not such only just a nostalgia trip in a way. Because even with your contributing editors, I think you want like completely different voices, perhaps, from the magazines that are already on the newsstands.
Yeah, definitely not a nostalgia trip. I mean, with this launching with a website, it helps us prove this, you know, it's not a nostalgia project because we're doing really exciting, forward-facing digital design, graphics. We're working with Bureau Borsch in Munich. Our art team, headed up by Alex O'Brien, are doing an amazing job at encouraging real fresh new talent. So I think on that basis alone, it's quite clearly not a nostalgia project. And, you know, the team is really young. We've got people from 20 right up to kind of my age all working on this. And, you know, everyone's bringing in such fresh new ideas and we want to capture culture as it's happening and certainly not looking to the past too much. Although, obviously respecting the amazing heritage.
Stuart, I have a question. I'm sure our listeners would be curious. I mean, in terms of the dates, like when more or less will the website be live and when the first print issue is coming as well?
Yeah, so the website is launching on the 17th of April and then the magazine will follow. It's a quarterly print edition and that's going to be the September issue.
And that's Stuart Bromford, who's the new editor of The Revived Face, as he says, online from today. And imprint in the autumn. You're with The Daily from Monocle 24. Stay with us. We'll look through some of the top stories from the Francophone press in just a minute.
Tune in now to Mitty Class by Chanel on Monocle 24. Join us over 5 fascinating episodes as we explore the craftsmanship, precision, artistry and design philosophy of the House of Chanel with its family of collaborators. The season began in homage to the late, great Karl Lagerfeld, who for decades stood for the best of a brand with a truly unique heritage. We heard too from Chanel fashion president Bruno Pavlovsky, and you can hear more from some of those who know this storied brand better than anyone else, as Pharrell Williams and Lady Amanda Harlech join Monocle's editor Tyler Brulé to tell him more about the inner workings of the fashion house. Tune in at monocle.com via our app and other channels or on Chanel's 355 podcast at iTunes. Mitty Class by Chanel on Monocle 24. Listen now.
Well, let's take a look at some of the stories making headlines in the press. We're going to focus on the Francophone press today. My guest in the studio today is Marie Billon, who's a journalist here in the UK for French media. Thank you very much for coming in this evening. Obviously, a huge amount of news coverage in the wake of Monday's fire at Notre Dame. But among the articles, some just pointing out there's a certain disparity in 800 million euros being pledged so very quickly for its rebuilding.
Yes, it's basically the attack of Libération, so a left-leaning newspaper, asking basically, well, there's two pieces in the Libération. One is an opinion edit by the chief ed, and he says that Emmanuel Macron says that in 5 years' time Notre-Dame can be rebuilt. What about the 3,600 homeless that's been basically on the streets of Paris for more than 10 years? What about them? Why the discrepancy? And there's another piece, a fact-checking piece in Libération, saying, so is it true, do we give more for a building that had just caught fire a few days ago than for people living in the street for years? And basically they say, well, it depends how you want to see it, because we gathered almost 1 billion, and all in all, in 2018, for the homeless, it was gathered 1 billion as well. So, of course, the difference is that that's in 3 days for Notre Dame, and that's in 1 year for the homeless in 2018. But at the moment, basically, it's neck and neck. So we can't really say that there's such a big discrepancy, because it's quite, you know, acknowledged that there won't be, I mean, the big money for Notre Dame has already arrived. There won't be more big check normally. There will be small donations. So in terms of, you know, of the big price tag, there's this comparison to make. But of course, I mean, those big fortunes, they give that many euros for a building. They would not give that many euros for homeless. We never saw someone give 100 million for people to be rehoused. If we arrive to 1 billion for homeless, the Libération said, it's because of, you know, small donations. It's also because of all the campaigns that are happening on the ground and all that. So if you dig into it, of course, yes, this is a discrepancy, and that can't be figured out at the moment. But it's true that you can see that people are more moved by a medieval building in flame than seeing someone on the street begging for money.
It reminded me, in a way, of the coverage that happened in Britain nearly 30 years ago now, when Windsor Castle caught fire. Mm. And the British government's immediate reaction was to say, obviously, we will cover all the costs of rebuilding this. And then quite quickly, you got the sense that the public reaction was, hang on a minute, this is a castle owned by one of the world's richest people. Why are we rebuilding? And similarly, you get a lot of people who said, well, firstly, as you say, if people have got a spare 100 or 200 million euros lying around, there are other things they could choose to spend it on. And also, the Catholic Church is not renowned for being in poverty.
No, that's true. And that's something that we still have to hear from in terms of the money they're gonna put in. The state in itself is not putting a lot of money, or is not putting any money, as I understand. The town hall of Paris is putting 50 million, but it's the city, so it's a bit different. The aim, of course, for the government, that it doesn't have to foot the bill at all. And because they want to say it's the people's cathedral, we haven't put any money, you rebuilt it yourself. At the same time, of course, that's a very, you know, very nice communication gesture, but also they'll be happy not to put any money in it. But the scale of the donations by those big fortunes, and the fact that first it was one saying, oh, I'm going to donate 100 million, and then another one, oh, I'm going to donate 200 million. It looked like, you know, an auction in a way.
It was a bit like a bidding war, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Who could give the most?
At the start, it was exactly that, yes. And that was what was completely incomprehensible, because there were so many... It was already happening when people were still in shock. And so many people in France basically was... comparing their sentiment, a bit shamefully, but compare the sentiment in front of what was happening to the attacks that happened in Paris. There was the same feeling that of hopelessness, of something very much in the heart of the nation being destroyed. Although we knew it was not the death of people, it was still very much very, you know, personal. And you can see all those people, giving their checkbook already, whereas where there was those people dying on the street, they were not basically forthcoming in terms of, oh, we're going to help, hospitals, for example, or we're going to donate our blood or something like that. There was not the same kind of outpouring of help at the time. So the idea that it's very comforting in a way, because Notre Dame is loved by everyone. So knowing that it will be rebuilt for sure because we will have the money is great. But we have to, yes, and kind of understand basically humanly what did it say about us.
Let's move on to some other stories. There's a feature in Le Monde on the origins of the Yellow Vest movement.
Yes, it's a very long feature, very interesting, basically, not covering, not asking, will there be a Gilets Jaunes movement this weekend? That's going to be interesting to see if something happens in Paris after what happened to Notre Dame. But basically, the feature is focusing on, is the Gilets Jaunes really a spontaneous movement, or was there already something fomenting behind? And what the piece said very clearly is that there was already something fomenting behind. There were many dozens of Facebook groups that was called Colère, and then the number of the department. So Colère means, anger, and the number of the department. So Colère 72, Colère 88. And those local groups basically start gathering the anger of the people at the start of 2018, so basically almost a year before the Gilets Jaunes arrived. And they were basically against the rise of the price of tobacco, they were against the lowering of the speed limit on the road and all that. So there was something already happening, something in terms of the internet already gathering support against what the state were doing to people who were seen as the first victims. So the poorer people who have to take their car for a long journey to go to work, poor people who smoke, and afterwards, of course, when the fuel tax was put in, poor people who don't have the money basically to for this tax. And when digging in, Le Monde is realizing that those groups basically were very much followed by what we called the patriosphere. So people who are saying they are patriotic, they would be leaning clearly on the extreme right of the political playfield, and because it resonated with what they have, the injustice that they want to build on, basically, and all that happening in like 10 months. And when November arrived and there was a tax fuel, it was very easy to basically morph those local groups into protests on the street, because it was not just saying oh, what about meeting at a roundabout this Saturday. It was already, those groups already had thousands of supporters, so it was very easy to say we're going to morph into something else and we're going to meet there. And after, and then there were a few add-on like the yellow vest and all that, but basically the thought that we had at the beginning, there was very much a popular movement, completely, not anarchic, but with no head, with a single purpose that is so, so entrenched to ourselves that we don't have to communicate between ourselves. We just, go on the street because we have the same purpose. It's kind of a, human being need to do that, is apparently a bit too romantic. And there were very much people pulling the strings behind it. And Le Monde is saying it's mainly people from the right-hand side of the political playfield that were pulling the string.
Just briefly before we finish, questions about a monument linked to Belgium's colonial past.
So it's Le Soir. It's one of the main daily newspaper of Belgium. And basically, there's a big debate at the moment in Belgium about how do you live with your colonial past. Recently, at the start of the month, the Prime Minister said sorry to children who were born from a white father and a black mother and were taken from their mother to be raised in Belgium without the mother having a say. So he said sorry at the start of the month. One museum's reopened at the start of the month as well, reshuffling its collection to basically represent the bad of decolonization as well, which wasn't the case. And another one is closing for 4 years to do exactly that. And there's a kind of a committee of mayors who've decided that all the statues, all the plaques that are remembering the colonial past of Belgium, we should keep them. But we should put some kind of, notice on the side saying, okay, so this is why this man on this statue has been put there. But now we know, and now we can explain to you why he was put there and what he did. And in this context, remember the story, the history of your nation, be informed about what it is. But let's not just get rid of the statue. Let's keep it there as a reminder of basically the history and owning the history of Belgium. Of course, it resonates a lot with what's happening in the US and the question of the statue, should we pull them down or not? And apparently Belgium has decided to just, own its history.
That's a really interesting, as you say, it's a debate that goes on in the United States. It goes on in the UK as well, because of Britain's obviously colonial past. That's a very interesting way, perhaps, of looking at it. We'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. But thank you very much for coming in this evening at Marie Bion with those stories from France and Belgium. You're listening to The Daily. We end tonight's programme with another tall story, and this week it takes us to Portland. The Coin Centre occupies an entire city block. This Art Deco skyscraper is today an icon, but it wasn't always so warmly welcomed, as Carlotta Rebello explains.
Right across from the Hawthorne Bridge in downtown Portland lies one of the most recognisable buildings of this city skyline, the Coin Centre. Built in 1984, the Coin Centre is home to restaurants, office spaces and apartments alike. And due to its scale, occupying an entire city block, it's almost as if each side of the building has a life of its own. To one side, you'll find the entrance to the residential area. To the other, a plaza. And turn a corner and you'll find a fountain. From its inception, the Coin Centre was all about the importance of public space and how to blur the lines that separate the different lives unfolding in each floor. From a distance, it immediately stands out due to its pyramid-like top and its orange brick facade dotted with white limestone at the base. Reminiscent of the Art Deco-style skyscrapers from the early 1920s, this modernist construction towers over the adjacent streets. It was named Fountain Plaza originally, but it quickly wore off, with people calling it Coin Center instead, after one of its biggest tenants, the television network of the same name that occupies the basement with studios and the upper floors with offices. Taking full advantage of the building's architecture, the blue spire at the top of the tower is used to house the antennas and all other necessary equipment used for broadcasting. For nearly 20 years, it was also home to the six-screen Coin Centre Cinema, until its closure in 2004. But this wouldn't be a story worth telling without a bit of controversy in the mix. When it was being built, the Coin Centre faced some opposition, not because of its 35 floors or even its aesthetics, but rather the location. You see, it directly blocks the view of Oregon's iconic Mount Hood, which had been welcoming drivers heading eastbound from Portland for decades. Nonetheless, the project went ahead, and today those privileged views are reserved for the owners of the penthouses on the top floors. Looking back at the Coin Centre today might not seem revolutionary, but at the time of its construction, this was Portland's own experiment in mixed-use buildings and how to strike that ideal balance. And while we're not saying this was the perfect formula, it was a valid attempt that has stood the test of time.
Carlotta Rebello there, and more city stories in The Urbanist. The next episode premieres at 1900 London time Thursday on Monocle 24. That's it for this edition of the Monocle Daily. The programme was produced by Bill Lutie and Tom Hall. Our researchers, Daphne Karnesis and Rory Goodrick. And our studio manager was Kenya Scarlett. Tig Enright will be here for The Globalist. It starts 8 hours from now at 7 a.m. London time. I'll be back with another daily at 2200 in London tomorrow evening. For now, though, from me, Paul Osborne, thanks for listening and goodbye.